Welcome to the Science Update Podcast. I'm Bob Hirshon, and this is the podcast for May 16th, 2008. This week, we've got some interesting stories about what happens when genes and the environment collide. The results can be mind-boggling. We'll trace birds back to dinosaurs and tell you about some of the latest threats to the health of our oceans. But first, Suzanne, I understand you have an amazing story of evolution in action unfolding on an island in Croatia.
That's right. Bob, how well do you remember the year 1971?
Oh, let's see. There were the Apollo 14 and 15 lunar landings. I think that's when Louis Armstrong died. And Idi Amin became president of Uganda. And a 1964 Studebaker known as the Beast first began to prowl the streets of Pembroke, Massachusetts.
Would you have anything to do with that?
I'm taking the fifth.
Right. And don't forget that women gained the right to vote in Switzerland for the first time that year.
How could I forget?
And 1971 also just happens to be the year I was born.
I would never have guessed. But anyway, what does any of this have to do with lizards?
Well, I'm getting to that. Turns out, in the mere 36 years I've been alive, a population of lizards has evolved a new organ in their bodies.
Whoa, wait a minute. In only 36 years? Is that even possible?
Well, Charles Darwin didn't think so. In fact, he thought evolution by natural selection occurs too slowly to observe in a human lifetime. But since then, many organisms have been caught in the act of evolving. Few, however, as dramatically as the Italian wall lizard. In 1971, 10 of these small reptiles were introduced to the tiny Croatian island of Podmrcaru. Formerly insect eaters, the newcomers were forced to adopt a plant-based diet in their new home. Biologists Duncan Ershik of the University of Massachusetts Amherst and Anthony Hurrell of Harvard and the University of Antwerp and their colleagues in Croatia now study the lizards. According to Ershik, the lizards quickly evolved larger heads and stronger bites better suited to eating plants. But the most surprising adaptation occurred in the gut.
What's important to understand is the very, very small island. You can walk from one end of it to the other in 5 or 6 minutes. There aren't very many insects there, which means there's not a lot of food for lizards. But what the island does have is it has a lot of plant vegetation matter. And so when we actually looked at the diets of the lizards that were introduced onto this very small island, what was distinctive was that their diet had really shifted much more to a plant-based diet. And over about 36 years, their guts actually evolved. They evolved this new valves called cecal valves, which are structures in their stomach that enable these animals to break down and process the plant material that they're now digesting. And these kind of changes are really dramatic. I mean, it would be the equivalent of humans evolving a new ear or a new nose in a matter of several hundred years. And that's never been documented before.
He says the discovery highlights just how quickly some organisms respond to natural selection, because even hatchlings possess the new gut structure instead of acquiring it in response to the environment as they mature. The lizards are so successful that there are now 5,000 on the island. He says he and his colleagues don't yet know how the new gut structure evolved from the tissue surrounding it, but says they will be studying the lizard population on Podmrcaru for many years to come in order to find out.
Wow, thanks, Suzanne. It is amazing such changes can take place that fast. Now, the environment doesn't always result in natural selection. It can have just as dramatic an effect on genes in other ways. You see, genes may be the blueprint for life, but scientists are now discovering that geography and physical environment can substantially affect how often certain genes are turned on. Geneticist Youssef Igdador of North Carolina State University and his colleagues wanted to find out how living in an urban environment affects people's genes.
The idea was to look at a human population which has the same genetic makeup but still live very distinct lifestyles in very different geographic domains.
So they compared the gene expression of three populations of Moroccan Berbers, urbanites from the city of Agadir, farmers from the Atlas Mountains, and Bedouin nomads of the Sahara Desert. He says that while the genetic code of the three populations is indistinguishable, their gene expression differs by up to 30%.
The genes are actually very specific. So, for example, we discovered that many genes have been associated to respiratory diseases are highly upregulated or turned on in the urban population, which makes sense because we know that this urban population is exposed to more pollution, for example.
In fact, he says an urban lifestyle accounted for much of the difference in gene expression.
We were really surprised by the magnitude and the specificity of the effects, and we didn't expect to see as many differentially expressed genes at a very significant levels. So our main conclusion is that gene expression can be very context-dependent. Things like lifestyle and geography or different pathogens can influence how genes are expressed. So the same population with the same genetic makeup can show very different expression profiles when you put them in different lifestyles or different environments.
He says much remains to be discovered about how the environment affects gene expression in humans and other species. Next, Suzanne has an update on the relationship between dinosaurs and birds.
You've probably heard that birds are the closest living relatives to dinosaurs. That's because they share many physical features with dinosaur fossils. But confirming their genetic relationship was difficult because DNA breaks down so quickly. However, DNA codes for proteins, which are more durable. Now scientists have sequenced a type of protein called collagen from the bone of a Tyrannosaurus rex that was unearthed in 2003. Then they compared the amino acid sequences, those are the building blocks of protein, to those of a variety of living animals. Biologist Chris Organ of Harvard University led the sequencing project.
Even though we only have a small number of amino acids for the tyrannosaur, there's enough signal in those data to place it with birds in roughly the right part of the tree.
As if dinosaurs weren't enough, Organ and his colleagues also sequenced the collagen of a mastodon and confirmed its close relationship with elephants.
There were more sequences available for mastodon, and so there was much more information to build the tree with. One of the problems with the tyrannosaur is there was a lot of missing information, which makes it difficult to place it on a tree, but not impossible in this case. And we have pretty good support that it groups with birds, basically like a 90% level of support. Some of the other groups, for example, like mastodon and elephant group, with 100% support or near 100% support.
He says the technique could be used to illuminate the evolutionary relationships of other extinct animals as well.
Thanks, Suzanne. Next, we're going to turn to the health of the oceans. Justin Warner's here with a story about an underwater oxygen crisis.
If the air over a heavily populated area was rapidly losing oxygen, it would trigger a global crisis. Yet right now, many parts of the ocean are suffering serious oxygen shortages, which could threaten marine life worldwide. In a recent report, physical oceanographer Janet Sprintle of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography and her colleagues charted out oxygen levels in six tropical ocean regions over the past 50 years. They found that areas of abnormally low oxygen have been expanding vertically.
So it's become both shallower in the upper layer and deeper at depth. And the oxygen level itself in three of those regions in the Atlantic has also decreased.
Oxygen depletion has been tracked for years in lakes and coastal waters. It's responsible for dozens and dozens of so-called dead zones where nothing can survive, including one in the Gulf of Mexico that's the size of New Jersey. But this study shows that oxygen depletion is also happening far out to sea. And while coastal dead zones are often driven by agricultural runoff, Sprintle says the chief culprit here is global warming.
The way oxygen is dissolved into the ocean depends upon temperature. A warmer ocean surface can't dissolve as much oxygen as colder surfaces.
If the oxygen continues to deplete, it could force many marine species to abandon their usual home waters, if they survive at all. And it looks like we'll have to put the brakes on global warming to turn the tide.
Thanks, Justin. Suzanne, you've got another story about preserving ocean life?
Yeah. North American right whales got their name because they were the favorite prey of whalers. But today, only 400 of the whales remain. They're protected from hunting, but now the whales' biggest enemies are large ships, and they're often killed by collisions with them. That's why Cornell researchers have invented the Right Whale Listening Network. It's a series of buoys near Cape Cod, Massachusetts, that listen for the calls of the right whales and then send out a warning to ships in the area to slow down.
Thanks, Suzanne. Well, that's our show for this week. Next week, we'll be talking about new trends in medicine, from cell phones that could save lives in developing countries to a CSI-inspired technique for rooting out hepatitis C infections in hospitals. Until then, tune into the Science Update Podcast Daily Edition. We cover every subject from atherosclerosis to zinc deficiency and all sorts of other science topics, too. You can find it on our website or at iTunes. Thanks for listening. I'm Bob Hirshon for AAAS, the Science Society.